I remember as if it was yesterday wandering around the presidential palace in Delhi, seeking, in fact, to have a cup of tea with the president. And everywhere there were images, statues, paintings of Gandhi. And, of course, I talk of Mahatma Gandhi. And there were echoes of this cult of personality pretty much everywhere I went in the country. But nobody seemed to take the slightest notice of what he actually said. Now, let me give you a quote. "God forbid that India should ever take to industrialism after the manner of the West, the economic imperialism of a single tiny island," he was referring to England, "is today keeping the world in chains. If an entire nation of 300 million took to similar economic exploitation, it would strip the world bare like locusts." Well, 81 years later, and with a population well over the billion, those words of wisdom appear to have fallen on deaf ears, and looking at the rate of industrialisation undertaken in today's India, except perhaps on the ears of my next guest, Vandana Shiva, who's been advocating in India and beyond for changes in the way we live on this planet. She last advocated them on our Little Wireless program in November 2001. And Vandana, it's very naughty of you to have stayed away that long.
Well, that depends on when you call me, isn't it?
let me give you the proper billings here. You've been described as one of the world's most radical scientists, a physicist, directed the Research Foundation for Science, Technology and Natural Resource Policy, and founder of Navdanya, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, a national movement that works with farmers in establishing seed banks. Vandana has been honoured with oodles of awards, including the Alternative Nobel Prize, the Livelihood Award, and she's the author and editor of umpteen books. I'm holding her latest in my hand, Soil Not Oil, Climate Change, Peak Oil and Food Insecurity, all of which we've discussed on the program, but I look forward to an even more energetic discussion with you. I understand you're in Madrid at the moment.
Yes, I'm in Madrid to advise President Zapatero, who set up a scientific committee for creating a new paradigm for the 21st century and to govern Spain on its basis. Because the old paradigm is collapsing, 20% unemployment, all the buildings that were supposed to create a boom in this country standing still, the old contractors turning into bank robbers. We're really seeing the end of a system based on fossil fuel, based on greed, and based on the kind of predatory economic exploitation that Gandhi was referring to in that quote you started the conversation with.
Your premise, and with which I'm thoroughly familiar, is that Western nations are going about solving or attacking climate change in absolutely the wrong way, by allowing big corporations to effectively profit from it. Can you give me the essence of this objection?
Well, there are actually three ways in which the very companies that gave us climate change and gave us atmospheric pollution are now trying to gain from solutions that are being offered. The first is the carbon trading that came out of the Kyoto Protocol and is still being given a big push in the follow-up solutions. And this basically means that countries, governments allocate for free rights to the atmosphere to the big polluters, who can then trade those rights to not reduce pollution and make someone else's reduction in pollution become a credit that they can buy. This effectively means the polluter gets paid rather than the environmental principle of the polluter should pay. None of the polluters are paying, they're getting rewarded, and now the carbon trade is trillions of dollars, which is what they're seeking to make. And the same instruments are being used for carbon trading as the instruments that brought the entire financial economy to a halt and burst the bubble. The carbon trade will lead to the same bubble because the same investment firms, it's the same derivatives logic, it's the same hedge funds seeking money and trying to create a fictitious economy. The second place where the polluters are seeking to gain at the cost of the earth, the planet, and the poor is the very false solution of biofuels. If you hear what the fossil fuel industry, the oil industry, saying, they're talking about biofuels as the big place where they're going to grow. Now, biofuels aren't a solution to climate change because they actually use a lot of fossil fuel for their production, both in the production of the crops with huge amounts of fertilizer and in the conversion of grain into liquid petrol or diesel to drive cars.
I think the listeners are well aware of that argument. So let's move now on to...
Well, the third one that they're trying to do is resell hazardous nuclear technologies as a clean technology.
And, of course, you were trained in nuclear physics, as I recall.
That's where I started, and if I hadn't been woken up to nuclear risks and hazards, that's where I would have been, probably negotiating with the United States on how to get India to pay more to the United States to set up nuclear power plant. Hillary Clinton has just been in India getting $10 billion out of poor India.
I'd like to talk to you in the 10 or 15 minutes we have about your solution, not only for India but for the wider world in terms of food production, because you're advocating a return to soil, to small organic farming, away from industrialized agriculture.
The two reasons why we have to move away from large-scale industrialized agriculture. First, because it is a major source of emissions of greenhouse gases. If you look at crop production, synthetic fertilizers are a very, very major input, and they emit nitrogen oxides, which are 300 times more lethal for global warming than carbon dioxide. If you look at factory farming, on the one hand, animals use 10 times more protein in grain than they produce, and factory farms are a major source of methane, which is another lethal greenhouse gas, besides, of course, giving us new diseases like the swine flu. None of this all produces more food. I think the biggest fiction and the biggest lie we've been told is that industrial agriculture produces more food. It doesn't produce more food per unit acre of land. It doesn't produce more food per drop of water. It doesn't produce more food per ray of sunshine. It only produces more per unit human input, but that is not what is scarce on the planet. We have enough people. And productivity is defined only in terms of labor input, which means the bigger your farms, the bigger your tractors, the more your fossil fuel, automatically you say more food is being produced per capita. But the second place where the calculations are wrong is because instead of measuring food output in terms of nutrition per acre, what is measured is yield of commodities per acre. So the more you can grow soybean in Brazil and export it for cattle feed, you're supposed to be growing more food.
I should point out to the listeners that you've worked with local communities and organizations serving more than 2 million farmers.
Yeah.
And you've managed to conserve more than 2,000 rice varieties from all over the country. And you've established 34 seed banks in 13
states.
Well, it's
gone up to 50 now. You know, our data's always a little dated. I've just inaugurated the latest 50th seed bank in Rajasthan, where the drought is compelling farmers to look for seeds.
Well, Monsanto, DuPont and Dow won't like you very much.
And they're stealing. I mean, they are stealing our climate-resilient crops and now patenting them as if it was their discovery and not farmers' breeding and nature's evolution. And this is one more in the line of breeding. But coming back to the solution to climate change and food insecurity, the point is biodiverse farming, which can only be practiced on a small scale, actually gives you more food per unit acre, more nutrition per unit acre. Most of the people on this planet are actually farmers. People forget that. Even now, 50% are farmers. With a little effort, all the people who are becoming unemployed with the economic crisis, instead of blowing up $2 trillion on bailout of banks, as President Obama did, if he had put that $2 trillion to put the unemployed on small gardens, urban gardens, small farms, you would have a solution to climate change and you would have a solution to unemployment and to hunger and malnutrition.
Vandana, the fact that there are so many Indians still working on the land is therefore not a sign of India's backwardness, it is a way for the future.
Absolutely, which is why I've been throwing my weight behind every struggle in which farmers want to defend their land, their farming, in the face of appropriation by industry. And if you notice the last elections in India, they were very, very much determined by farmers' struggle for their land sovereignty. I do believe India's future lies in her small farms and in the land.
Mind you, there's a lot of repair work to be done in India, isn't there? The ruination of the land, the taking it away for the biofuel plantations, even the building of roads.
Of course, that plus the fact that first as the Green Revolution beginning in the 60s, which left Punjab, one of the most fertile areas of India, a barren land, and forced me to do my study, which led to the book called The Violence of the Green Revolution. And now with Monsanto entering with its GM seeds, starting with cotton, two things we have found. One, that in the 10 years in which they've been around, first with trials and now with the actual commercial sales, more than 200,000 farmers in India have committed suicide. Most of them are concentrated in areas where seed monopoly has been established. And that's not all. The toxic seeds of BT cotton are also killing soil microorganisms. We've just done a study. In 4 years of planting, 30% of beneficial organisms had been killed. Now, these are the sources that allow us to return carbon to the soil, that allow biomass to be degraded and turned into humus and soil fertility. So we are really, literally, through genetic engineering and these monopolies, killing farmers, killing the soil, and killing the future. And unfortunately, everywhere, the propaganda and lies of these companies rule so much because they manage to buy up every platform.
Vandana, tell the listener about what you call earth democracy.
Well, for me, earth democracy is really the next step we need to take. If we have to solve the planetary crisis of climate change, if we have to solve the economic crisis where we created a crazy model that said that everyone must shop and shop and shop, and the only identity we have is consumers, and the production can take place in China, which will be the manufacturing capital of the world, and everyone will be reduced to consumers of bad goods. What we need for the next step, given the triple crisis of the economy, of capital, of the climate, and of food and energy, what we need is earth democracy. Earth democracy both to reclaim control over our lives and over our daily affairs.
Well, it's a lovely phrase, earth democracy, but what does it mean and how does it work?
Well, it works, firstly, that you make decisions linked to the earth. You are part of the earth family. You make decisions about your water locally. You make decisions about your food systems through food sovereignty and food democracy. And this is not just an empty concept, because we started a movement based on this idea in 2000. More than 6,000 villages joined, and now they govern their water, they govern their forests, they govern their biodiversity, and these are the areas where ecological destruction hasn't taken place. These are also the areas where everyone has a share to the common resources. But earth democracy also means having a planetary consciousness that we are earth citizens, and earth citizenship is our first identity. Consumerism is not our identity, and as Earth citizens, first, we must respect the Earth and her limits, but second, the Earth and us, our nature is creativity, and we have to reclaim our productivity, creativity, and become makers and creators again, something that has been robbed from most people on this planet.
You're right that renewable energy economies can only be built through the renewable energy of free and self-organized citizens and communities.
Yes, I really believe that, because otherwise we are going to get, in the name of renewable energy, we are going to get nuclear, which isn't renewable. We are going to get biofuels, which aren't renewable. We are going to get the same reproduction of centralized structures that are wasteful, non-sustainable, inequitable. To create an authentic earth democracy, we need a democratization of energy. And energy, first and foremost, a political transformation is people's energy.
Mm. There's a Swedish study that you're well aware of, which found that the food miles of a typical breakfast would cover the circumference of the earth. This is the distance that food ingredients travel from point of origin. And of course, you're not alone in saying this has to end.
Both because these food miles are then emitting massive amounts of greenhouse gases. A Danish study had shown that 1 kilogram of food moving around the world is emitting 10 kilograms of carbon dioxide. But the point is, once you have that kind of long-distance transfer of food, what you get is food being turned into non-food. Things that should perish aren't allowed to perish through genetic engineering, through pesticides, through chemical additives. And, you know, when I come to the West, I realize the difference between a fresh yogurt we set at home and Danone's yogurt that tastes like plastic. The same happens to everything else. You cannot have a good food system that's sustainable and worthy of being called food, food that nourishes us and turns into our cells and blood, if we are, all we are thinking about is how to ship it to the longest distance and maximize in the process both the control and the profits of a few players.
Vandana, talking about transport, you remind readers in the new book that India is now becoming, well, perhaps is destined to be the chief manufacturer of automobiles, although many of those are for export. How is this impacting on India thus far?
Well, the first thing, the first way in which it's impacting is our cities have just become choked with automobiles. Neighbors,
well, they've always
neighbors.
Been choked.
But they weren't choked
but
with,
not
automobiles.
With automobiles.
They were choked
no.
with people and cycles and yes. cows and tongas, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
A whole diversity of people. And
much
you
more fun.
Your behavior
yeah.
The cities are then being redesigned for the automobile. I mean, there's really the death of pedestrian walkways in our cities, even though the majority of people walk. The car owners of our country, as my book shows, is only 4%. Now, 4% of India is destroying the remaining India. That's why, you know, when we talk of global equity, it doesn't get reflected into internal equity. It doesn't get reflected because 4% of India needs superhighways. It needs flyovers in the cities because as more automobiles choke more traffic, they build more highways to be able to move the traffic, but it's never enough because there are always more automobiles coming out.
I was charmed by your revelation that you can reverse the process and you instant Cuba, which made the transition from tractors to oxen.
Because of the trade sanctions, which didn't allow them to get their diesel supply. And, you know, if peak oil is serious, and it is, and you know, the geologists are telling us that, you can be very sure that all these automobiles that are being planned will not be able to run. Even biofuel can't manage to keep the automobile populations moving because in the U.S., as my book says, 20% corn being converted to biofuel only substituted 1% of fossil fuel. All corn being replaced would only substitute 7%. That means 93% would have to be grown somewhere else. So, A, where will the food grow? And the planet doesn't have enough land to be able to service this automobile overpopulation with food being converted to oil.
And the Spaniards are listening to you at the moment.
Well, the president is, for sure. And I think he's very serious. And we've had a full-day discussion yesterday on how to build a new paradigm for a new century that is ecologically sustainable and understands the limits of the earth and the imperative of climate change, that is deeply equitable. And we had a wonderful conversation because he, you know, Zapatero, one of the first things he did was pass a law to end machismo. And I said, you know, a lot of the machismo is in the mind, and we've got to end the machismo of the mind, the kind of technocratic centralized civilization that is part of machismo of the industrial age.
I didn't know he passed a law against it. That's a
he passed a law against it. He said, if we can't get rid of machismo, we cannot move.
Dear, oh dear. I like the cut of his jib, Vandana.
But, you know, also Gandhi used to say a daily prayer to say, make me more womanly.
Well,
and I think it was that gaze of Gandhi that allowed him to see the huge predation that the industrial fossil fuel-based machinery was putting on people and the planet.
We've got to wrap it up, but what a woman. Vandana Shiva, Director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology and National Resource Policy. And she's talking to us from Madrid, where she is changing Spain overnight. The latest book, Soil Not Oil, Climate Change, Peak for Oil and Food Insecurity. It's published in South Asia by Women Unlimited By arrangements with Zed Books, we'll put details up on the web. Victoria's bushfire strategy in ashes on our next. And we'll continue with the psychotherapist and traumatologist Paul Valent about surviving trauma. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news. And we'll see you later. And watch your footprint.